Welcome to Try Lawyer Talk. I'm Scott Glovsky, and I'm your host for this podcast where we speak with some of the best trial lawyers in the United States. First, I want to apologize for taking a couple weeks to get this episode out. Occasionally, given my trial schedule, that'll happen, but hopefully not too often. We're moving to our new format where we're going to issue a new episode every 2 weeks. Today, we're very lucky to have with us Joe Freed. Joe is an amazing human being. He's a passionate fighter. He's brilliant. And he's also a wonderful storyteller. Joe practices out of Atlanta, but he is truly one of the only lawyers I know who's constantly on the road trying cases for other lawyers around the country. And Joe specializes in trucking cases and other industrial commercial vehicle accident cases. And it's a real treat for me to have him with us. So let's get going. We are very lucky to have with us today one of the best trial lawyers, best human beings, and a tremendously powerful storyteller and powerful person, Joe Freed. Joe is a trial lawyer who truly has a national practice. Joe goes all around the country trying largely trucking cases, but all kinds of large litigation, large trials for other lawyers around the country. And I'm humbled and thankful to be sitting here across the desk from him. Joe, thanks for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me. I don't feel like I deserve the wonderful praises that you gave me, but those make me feel good. But I'm glad to be here.
Thank you. Joe, was there a case that had a profound impact on you?
There have been a couple of cases that have had profound impacts on me along the way.
Could you tell us a story?
Sure, I'll tell you about the first one. I had spent several years early in my career as a lawyer who focused on handling cases that involved medical negligence. And so I was working in a medical negligence firm, and I ended up getting a phone call from a friend of mine, colleague, who was in another state, who asked me if I would go check on a former client of his who had gotten in a terrible accident and was in a burn center in Atlanta. And so I went really less as a lawyer and more as a human, just to see if there was something that I could do for this lady or her family in this burn center. And it turned out that the woman had been in the process of moving her residence from apartment to apartment, and she had gotten hit from behind. Her car burst into flames, and she struggled to get out of the vehicle, and ultimately she was able to, she was giving up. She was praying. And she put her hands together as she felt her body burning. And she looked up and in prayer, and the convertible top of the car that she was in started to burn away. And so she climbed through that opening onto the hood of the car and out. She was fully engulfed in flames. Somebody, a passerby, stopped. Actually, turned out it was the singer Usher who was involved in putting her, sort of dousing her body out, getting her out of, making the flame stop. And she was, of course, transported to the hospital and in a terrible, terrible place. She was burned over the vast majority of her body. And the family asked me, since he was in the process of moving, and this really was not my field. Accidents were not what I was handling at the time as a lawyer. The family asked me if I would go. They didn't want to go to the car because of the state that the car would be in. But they wanted to see if some of their mother, it was her, their mother, their jewelry was in the car. There had been a jewelry box. So I went down to the wrecker site and I dug through the ashes. And you know what happens after a car catches fire on the roadway, especially if it's a convertible, the wrecker drivers just kind of throw everything into the back. You know, they clean up the scene and it becomes kind of the dumpster of the scene. So here I am. You know, back then as a med mal lawyer, I actually wore a coat and tie, I mean, a nice tie and shirt, and I looked like a lawyer. I don't really do that much anymore. But just take a minute and picture this, you know, young lawyer hanging into the back of a Ford Mustang that was all burnt to pieces, all burnt up, trying to find this lady's, what might be left of this lady's family stuff.
What was going through your mind?
Well, I was honestly just trying to be a helpful human at the time. But what struck me as I'm looking at this car, and I had spent, you may know this about me, I'd spent some years in law enforcement before I went to law school, so I had worked wrecks in that capacity. So I started looking at the car, and what struck me about it was, of course, it was all burnt up, but there was not really that much damage to it. When I looked at the actual damage from the accident, from the wreck, as we say down south, there really wasn't that much crush to the car. And I remember thinking, why on earth did this car catch fire? And so later, I wasn't able to find anything, by the way. My day with the car just resulted in a ruined suit and a ruined tie and a ruined white shirt. And even ruined shoes. My wife just had me put all of them into a bag when I got home, and I never saw them again. Let's just leave it at that. But what it did do is it made me go home and start to look at this Ford Mustang, which was this iconic car that I had kind of grown up seeing. And I was horrified. What I learned was that there were hundreds of people who had burned alive in Mustangs. And I was too young to really be around as a lawyer back in the old Pinto days. But it seemed to me...
And the Pinto days are when there were Pintos that were exploding that became the subject of a lawsuit.
That's right. That's right. And it was a big deal at the time. Ford got themselves in... I think it may have been the first time ever in history that a company, an actual like corporation, was held to be ethically wrong. You know, I think they may have even had criminal charges against some of the executives or something related to that case. But it seemed to me this was the same thing. And how could we not know? How could I not know? And I would ask people, hey, have you ever heard that a problem with the Mustang? And nobody had ever heard of anything. But yet, I was pulling up article after article of people who died. And I don't know what came over me. It was something compelled me. And as you fast forward through this story of Joe, just a couple of months in, I was consumed with this matter. And I was, my partners, I was in a partnership that allowed me to basically lay all other cases aside, have other lawyers work on them. And I started focusing my efforts, my attention on this to see. And I was calling people.
Let me stop you for a moment. If we were to take a step back and think, what was compelling you to do this?
You know, I don't know that I know the answer to that. But, you know, at the place where I am now, I don't believe in many coincidences. I think things happen and there is something that guides that. So I don't know what compelled me, except as I'm looking, I started calling people. I called parents of people who had died 10, 12 years before and said, and ask them, can I come and talk to you? And some of them would say, no, I don't know what you want, but I don't need a lawyer in my life. And some, a few, said yes, and I flew to places, and others I spoke to on the phone, and I talked to them about their loved ones and whether they knew of a problem, had anybody looked into this. And so I ultimately filed the case, and I felt, I have to tell you, I have to admit this to you, I felt that I was the wrong lawyer in every way. I felt that it was not my field, it was not my competency. There were all these other lawyers who I had heard of, who had big names, and who did these big, huge product liability cases, and I was just a lawyer who handled medical cases at the time. And I called my client, the son of my client. By that point in time, the woman, the mom, had died. She lived for 42 days. I sat with her and her family for about 14 of those days. I was there every day from the time I first went to try to look at the car, or from the time I went before that when they asked me to, until the day she died. I was at the hospital with the family, at least for a short period of time. And, you know, I just felt compelled to move forward. I filed the case, and then I psyched myself out. I was the wrong lawyer. I remember very well the conversation with one of the sons where I told him that I thought this was a very important case and that maybe a good lawyer should handle it, maybe somebody with a lot more experience than myself. And he told me something that I still get a little teary-eyed, you know, saying even now as I'm thinking about him. And I got to speak to him not long ago. He was a soldier. And he recently retired from the military. But he looked at me and said, nobody will love us more than you do. And you will hurt my feelings if you ask me again for another lawyer to handle the case. And I think he meant all the best by that. But what he did is he put tons of weight on my shoulders. And so that became 20-hour days for me. And the case became my life. 20-hour days, 7 days a week, learning, studying, digging, getting materials from Ford and other places, studying fuel system engineering, because that's what the case ended up being about. And it ended up being just like the Pinto case. And what struck me was that Ford never learned its lesson, and that they got caught on the Pinto and ultimately were forced to make changes there, but nobody forced them to make changes on the Mustang, so they had. And still we had a car that had a fuel tank that was just 6 inches inside the rear bumper. And nothing in that regard had changed. It had been beefed up, but not really solved. And so the case became something that was my life. I ended up somehow being involved in other Mustang cases around the country. People heard about the ridiculous amounts of time and energy that I was spending on this case, and they didn't want to do the work. They didn't see maybe the vision that I had for wanting to change this. And so at one point I had maybe 7 or 8 of these cases going at the same time, and Ford was really mocking me, frankly. They were pushing all the buttons to say, you're not lawyer enough.
How did that make you feel?
Well, they were winning that battle, I'm embarrassed to say. And if it hadn't been for the partners I had at the time, who I now look back on and say, I wonder if I would have had the trust in this then young lawyer to allow me to spend over $1 million on a single case, because Ford was not going to lose. They got literally dozens, more than 24 experts. And, you know, the case continued. And ultimately, you know, ultimately the case, I told Ford, once I had a lot of the cases, I said, you know, if you will just change the design of the Mustang, I'll stop suing you. Yeah. I got thrown out of the Detroit Auto Show for crawling up underneath the Ford Mustang one year to see what changes they were making in this new Mustang that was coming out. And I had designed a fuel system that I thought would work, and they took actually that design and improved on it an awful lot, thankfully. And ultimately they changed the design of the Mustang.
How did that happen? In other words, you're a lawyer who they're mocking, and you design a fuel system that ends up affecting the safety of millions of people on the road.
Well, let me tell you what happened. What happened is Ford, you know, Ford, I credit Ford for teaching me how to be a lawyer at first. And then there's this thing that we're sitting at now that took me from there, which was this place called the Trial Lawyers College that maybe we can talk about a little bit also. But what happened was Ford brilliantly, my great case, the one that I really wanted to try first, they somehow finagled a way to get another case to go to trial first that was much harder. It was going to be much harder. And what their plan was, frankly, was to win that case with great fanfare and publicize the result to destroy any value in the other cases. And I know this to be true. And they spent millions and millions and millions of dollars defending these cases and maneuvering this one particular case into position. And we tried that case, and it was the hardest of my cases, and it was the hardest because it was the hardest impact from behind. That's what made it the hardest. The product was the same product. They expected, and their lawyer flauntingly said how they were going to, quote, roll me out of the courtroom. It wasn't going to take the jury an hour to find for Ford, is what he kept saying to me at every opportunity. And we tried the case for a couple of months. It was several months long. I was far away from home. The case went to trial in California, actually. And after a grueling, long trial, the jury came back deadlocked. We were one juror shy of a verdict in our favor. And so we had to get ready to try it again. And something happened during that trial. And the only thing I can tell you is that I think it has something to do with respect and fear. And I'm not saying that I created fear, but I am saying that what happened there, and they ultimately told me this, if you could deadlock this jury on that case, then we don't want to see what would happen on the others. And so ultimately, I got a phone call as I was leaving for California or getting ready to go back and try the case again. After the case had been totally reworked up again, another $1 million in the costs. And they said, we changed the design. And I said, yes, I know. Yeah, we heard about the Detroit Auto Show. And I said, well, I had to see for myself. And they said, well, you know, one time you told us, I don't know if you remember this, but one time you told us that you'd stop suing us if we changed the design. And I said, I still believe that. And so they came down to Atlanta, and over the course of about a week, we went through case after case. And, you know, it's funny, I'm sitting here and I'm seeing my clients in my eye. I'm seeing this case, you know, still haunts me, I have to tell you. I mean, I can't look at a Mustang before the 2005 vintage and not see the car in flames, even now. And so I'm very proud, Scott, of being able to get a design changed for the future. But there's still many, many of those cars that are on the road before the design change. And there's a part of me, while I'm proud of what I did, there's a part of me that's embarrassed to say that I didn't go maybe far enough with it.
Tell me more about how you got to the point where this case still haunts you.
Well, it never stopped haunting me. You know, it was almost, and it's like I said before, I don't believe in coincidences anymore. You know, for some reason, in all, of all the lawyers out there, and you know, we have so many. I mean, there's so many. Why did I get tapped to go on a humanitarian mission one day to a hospital to talk to a family of a woman who got hit from behind and scar burned up? I don't know the answer, but I do know that I feel like it became a calling, if you can appreciate what I'm saying. And it almost, my wife would say it became a sickness, because it invaded my life. It took me away from my family. And so the reason it still haunts me is I know, you know, I made a conscious decision that I'd stop suing Ford. And they came in and they paid my clients a lot of money. And there's a part of me that feels like I sold out, even though good things happened. But I know fewer people have died and will die because of the changes that Ford wasn't going to make unless somebody took them to the mat. But I have said no to cases of real people. Families who have lost people. And so there's a part of me that feels that I still let them down. Because maybe if I had done more, maybe I would have been able to cause some additional change. But as I'm saying that to you, I'm also cognizant of one thing. I really went on a mission, internal sort of journey, at the time that I agreed to settle that case, to determine, to figure out if I really thought I could affect another change, a bigger change, and go back retroactively. And I don't think I could have. The only thing that could have happened is those cars would be taken off the road. That's never, ever happened. And I don't think it ever will. People love their old Mustangs.
I can feel the fight in Joe Freed, your drive and your passion. Where does that come from?
Well, you know, your listeners can't see the stunned look on my face, and if I sit here in silence, they won't be able to see the wheels turning as I'm trying to find the right words to answer your question. You know, I don't know. I know, I you know, I think it has to do with spending most of my life not feeling like I have not been good enough. And I think that it is a reaction to that. At some point in my teenagehood, I had to make a decision about where I was going to, how I was going to deal with that, maybe even before. And I chose to spend my life maybe trying to convince myself that I am. And so, that sounds maybe too noble to say.
Well, how far have you came in that journey?
God, I want to say a long way, but then I find that I don't know how long, how far. I mean, it's been a journey, and you know this, and your listeners may not, but I've spent the better part of the last 20 years on a very active journey that started through a professional college that you and I are both part of. So I'm much further along, because I never would have been able to understand myself enough to answer these questions that you've asked me. But for that journey, I recognize it. And so I know I've come a long way, but I also still feel that I have a long way to go. And I think, frankly, that's my life's work. I think it's my life's work, and maybe not only mine, but maybe there's other people who are listening to this who feel the same way I have in their life. And so it's part of our life journey, our mission, to do something to leave this place a little better than we found it. And while that sounds noble, it is also serving this internal psychosis, this internal need to feel that I've done something that makes me worthy of, you can fill in the blank, worthy of love, worthy of attention, worthy of life.
Can you share with us the story of why you became a lawyer? And in fact, I'd like to back up.
Sure.
And have you tell us your journey from the time you finished school, when you started to work in your first job, and how you became a lawyer.
Sure. I think it has to even go back a little bit further than that. And it has to go a little farther than that for you to really fully understand what I think is the answer to your question. And that, you know, I've always been somebody who's been a safety advocate. I've always been somebody who has abhorred the bully. I think back on times, I'm told of times that I don't even remember, that have been shared with me from when I was very, very young, when I would stick up for people who were picked on. And sometimes, maybe too often, I'd end up in fights with people and get myself in trouble. But it was about that. It was about me trying to stick up for somebody. Now, I have to admit something that's not that easy for me to admit in a forum like this where I don't know who may listen. But part of that has to do very much with the fact that I grew up the son of an alcoholic. And there were people in my family who had to be protected. And I was the oldest son. And so those who have had that experience know where I come from. So my life is in many ways a string of these situations where I have collected to me people who maybe are not the most popular, maybe are the brunt of the joke. And I've tried to do my part to protect them. I've not always succeeded. I have some sad stories that I won't tell because they're not really mine to tell, only mine to have been involved in. But, you know, that's how you can quickly go from there to at a very young age becoming a police officer. And then in the role of police officer, I viewed my job as to protect against the bully. That's really what I've always looked at my job as. The bully was not safe with me. I viewed myself as that was my role. And sometimes it got me into trouble. But again, it was my noble role. And so I could tell you countless stories about of examples of that. I won't bore you with them, but that has to be at the foundation of what took me to a point where, as a police officer, you know, that's a hard job. And those men and women out there. For the most part, from everything I've seen, are out there doing a righteous thing. And those people who do the righteous thing are just as horrified as anybody, when they, and more than most, when they see some bad policing. And you know what I mean. I mean, we see the press loves to cover that these days, disproportionately from the great things, that the heroic things that those men and women are out there doing. I mean, I'm so thankful that I live in a place where I have police officers. I'm also horrified that there are some bad ones, but we're getting off topic. One day, in the midst of my police career, so to speak, I was approached by a judge who I had been in front of many times, and he asked me if I would go to lunch with him. And I thought surely I had done something very, very, very wrong. And he basically asked me what the hell I was doing with my life. And by then I had spent enough time in courtrooms, including his courtroom, to have this feel about the place. I could feel the energy in a courtroom, and I knew important things happened there. And I knew that it wasn't always the right thing, but very important things. Lives were changed there. And it was a great place to fix the bully. And where else? And so I started thinking through that, and he pointed it out to me. And so, you know, I got out of, you know, fast forward, I go into law school and come out, and now as a civil attorney, I still view my job just like when I was in law enforcement. My job is to hold those responsible accountable. That's it. It's not to invent things. It's not to really do anything other than that. Hold those who are responsible accountable. And I have much better resources now than I ever had in law enforcement. It's different resources, but I can do things, and I can bring my creativity and all the things I'm interested in life, I can pull together. You know, I didn't tell you, I was a physics guy in school. So I was kind of, maybe that's why it made me look at that Mustang and say, why the hell did this crush damage cause that fire? So law became something that to me was a continuation of what I had done. And so fast forward and you can see why something like the Ford case happens. And why now? I told you I have to go a little bit further, and I won't go much further, but I'll just say that, you know, after I woke up the day after all those cases were settled, I had no cases. And for a lawyer, that's a scary place. And I fumbled around for a good year trying to figure out what I needed to be when I grew up. And then, in furtherance of what I told you about not believing in coincidences, for about 2 weeks leading up to a particular day, everything I looked at had to do with truck accidents. Everything, I would turn the TV on and there would be a horrible tragedy involving a truck. I'd open the newspaper and there'd be a truck story. I even got on an airplane, and in the pocket, the seat pocket in front of me, somebody left a trade magazine that was trucking, and it was open to a safety problem, an article about a safety problem in trucking. And so a couple of days after that, I was tossing and turning at night, asking myself the question of what I needed to be when I grew up. And I said, okay, I think, I don't believe in coincidences. So I think this is what I'm supposed to do. And so the very next morning, and keep in mind that at the time I had no truck cases. So the very next morning I went into work invigorated for the first time in a while. And I was waiting for, I wrote some personal notes and emails to some lawyers who had been really, really important in helping support me as a product liability lawyer. By that point in time, I had left the firm, that MedMal firm, and I was all by myself. And I was waiting for the one staff person who I pulled away with me when I left to tell her what my midlife crisis was. And the phone rang. And it was probably a little bit after 8 o'clock in the morning. And the woman on the other end asked for me by name. What can I do for you? And she told me that her husband had died that very morning, 3 o'clock in the morning, on the side of the road. And I asked her what happened, and she said, well, a truck killed him. And so I asked her, I said, how did you know to call me? And she said, I don't know. And I said, well, I'm leaving right now to come and see you. And so that very day at 3 o'clock in the morning was when I was tossing and turning and making the decision that the commitment that my new role in life was going to be to work on safety-related problems, cases that involve safety-related problems in the trucking world. And you know, that was almost 10 years ago now. And the vast majority of my cases, as you know, 90-some-odd percent of them are truck cases, almost 100% are truck cases, and this is my life now. And I'm blessed in that life to, I think, be making a difference. I'm surrounded by other lawyers around the country who I'm so proud of because they step to the plate time and time again to do the right thing. And together we can make a difference. So that's my story.
You're flying around the country, working round the clock, away from home, weeks on end at a time. Has being a trial lawyer taken something from you?
Oh, yeah. You know, there's, you know, somebody, I can't remember who it is credited with saying the law is a jealous mistress. They should meet the current, the modern day trial lawyer. You know, I mean, the world has gotten smaller, which means geographic diversity in the practice of law and specialization in the practice of law has made it so that, you know, here I am, I'm an Atlanta-based lawyer. I've handled truck cases. I think someone counted recently and said 31 states that I've worked in. And so part of that is also the more narrowly as a lawyer, and you know this, the more narrowly you draw your boundaries on what kind of cases you're going to handle, the bigger you have to allow your geography to be, if that makes sense. But to answer your question, it's taken a huge toll. This is people really have a misconception of what it's like to be a trial attorney. They think we, you know, it's some simple thing. It's all about cashing the check and working the system and those kinds of things. And maybe that exists, but I've not really seen that. And if someone's got it figured out, would call me after they hear this and tell me how to do that. I'd like to hear it at least. But my truth is that it's taken huge toll. I have recently been going through some things with some family stuff that involve addiction. And I realized in sitting in meetings trying to support that situation, I realized that my work is my drug of choice. It's where I have run to not deal with anything else really in my life that I didn't want to deal with. Or that I didn't want to deal with. So it has almost cost my marriage. It has cost years of me missing things with my children, although I've worked hard not to, and I've made sure they know that. It's cost health as I sit here and not the state of health that I'd like to be in, because it's hard when you're on airplanes constantly to stay in shape. But it's also been a tremendous honor for me. It has validated me. It is my life's work, and I would choose to do it again. even knowing the heartbreak that it would bring sometimes and the challenges that it would bring. There might be a few things I'd try to do a little differently, but I would choose it again, even if I had all those things over again.
What do you want your tombstone to say?
Here lies a man who made a difference. And I don't know that I need this to say this on my tombstone, but you know, my dad passed away about 5 years ago, and I was fortunate enough to be by his side when he did. And with me was the woman who he had been married to, the only woman he'd ever been married to, 60-year marriage, and his 5 children and a couple of grandchildren. And we laid there with him as he died. And it redefined my definition of success. Because surely at the end, to be surrounded, not because of a sense of duty or responsibility, but because every one of us wanted to be there, and there was nowhere else we would have rather been, this man who meant so much to all of us, who made a difference. That has to be the definition of success, I think. And so, you know, I hope, I guess here's my real answer, Scott. I don't care what it says on my tombstone. What I want to leave people with, you know, it's written somewhere, you know, people will forget, you know, sort of what you gave them or what, you know, those kind of things, but they won't forget how you made them feel. What's more important to me than what it says on my tombstone is how, by the end of my life, I have made people feel. And so if I can leave my wife such that she feels how much I cherish her, if I could leave my children so that they would know the depth of my love for them, if I could leave my friends feeling with the knowledge that I was a true friend to them, and if I could leave my profession, my colleagues, feeling that I lived my life to a significant degree in service of them, and if I could leave my clients knowing how much I feel gratitude for the trust they put in me, and if I could be surrounded in the end by those who I love and love me most, then I don't even need a tombstone.
Joe, you're making me cry.
Well, I don't mean to make you cry. But that's really what, I mean, I'm at a point now where, you know, your words at the beginning of this were so kind to me, and I appreciate what you said. I don't feel those things about what I've accomplished. I know I've accomplished good things, but I don't feel those things. I don't let myself feel them. Now I'm at a phase in my life where I still have important things to do safety-wise with trucking. And those who know me know that I don't hate truckers. I don't hate trucking. I just hate danger. I had bad decisions for bad reasons that cost people's lives, including truckers. But now I'm also blessed because I am given increasing opportunities to help teach, mentor, train other lawyers. And I've come to the realization that if I have learned what I have learned along the way, if I can just give that away to as many people who are willing to fight the bully, then they can accomplish a whole more than I can't accomplish. I'm only just me. And somewhere along the line, that validates me too. So it's a true blessing. It's even a blessing, especially a blessing, for you to ask me to be a part of what you're doing. And I'm proud of you, and I'm so happy that you're my friend, and that we've gotten some time to spend together, and that I always leave you, and I think I say it to you almost every time, I wish we had more time together, and I do. You'll live far, as my daughter, who's now 15, used to say when she was much, much younger, you live fire, fire away. And it's not always easy for us to stay in touch, but when we do, I know we start right back up. And isn't that the measure of a friendship at some level?
I'm very honored and blessed to have you in my life. And I truly, truly, from the bottom of my heart, want to thank you on behalf of your clients, on behalf of the hundreds of trial lawyers around the country that you've mentored, on behalf of all the folks who are not in danger because of the great work that you've done. You are the epitome of a true, powerful human being, powerful trial lawyer, an absolutely lovable man.
No, you're kind. Now I want to hug you. But you're going to have to take those ear things off before I do that. Nobody else can see those, but they're there. He's wearing them right now and listening to all of this through these huge ear things.
Thank you so much for doing
this. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you. Thank you for joining us today for Trial Lawyer Talk. If you like the show, I'd really appreciate it if you could give us a good review on iTunes, and I'd love to get your feedback. You can reach me at www.scottglovsky.com. That's scottglovsky.com. And I'd love to hear your feedback. You can also check out the book that I published called Fighting Health Insurance Denials, A Primer for Lawyers. That's on Amazon. I put the book together based on 20 years of suing health insurance companies for denying medical care to people, and it provides a general outline of how to fight health insurance denials. Have a great week, and we'll talk to you in the next episode.